A rise in anti-Semitic incidents in Georgia. What's behind it?
More than half a dozen local private school students are now expelled or suspended because of a drinking game they called Jews versus Nazis beer pong.
From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. We go behind the scenes of FX's Atlanta.
I started during the pilot, and it was a very hot summer in Atlanta. And the very first day, we were reading over the sides, and we were like, this show is going to blow up.
And the latest Southern novels, including a love story from prison.
Like Roy says, I'm going to write you a love letter. I never wrote you love letters when we were together, and I regret that now.
From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Let's go on location with the team behind Donald Glover's TV show, Atlanta.
I started during the pilot, and it was a very hot summer in Atlanta. And the very first day, we were reading over the sides, and we were like, this show is going to blow up.
That's ahead this hour. But first, last week we bade a fond farewell to Celeste Headlee, who departed this hosting chair and is now a special correspondent with GPB. On Friday, we turned the tables and I did her exit interview, asking her about her time on OST and her previous lives, including her time as co-host of WNYC's The Takeaway with now disgraced host John Hockenberry.
I mean, you just mentioned regrets, and I think that is one of my regrets, because if I had known that other women were being sexually harassed, I would have blown the whistle so much sooner. I would have not put up with being silenced and being let go. Frankly, I would have put my foot down. If I had known that it was not just me, I would have really raised a racket.
We had an outpouring of listeners letting us know what they thought of that interview and what they'll miss about Celeste. Here are your first thoughts. We got a call from Mandy Mahoney.
And I was calling to say thank you to Celeste, because I always look forward to listening to her, and I felt like she has brought a level of class and sophistication to our that we needed here in Atlanta, and I really appreciated how she was respectful but also really pushed us on issues around race. And I do hope that y'all fill her space with someone, definitely a person of color. We need to continue leading in that area. We've got a long way to go in Atlanta. I wish Celeste all the best in her next chapter. Thank you.
Thank you, Mandy. And of course, we got plenty of tweets. Ann Gerber said, whoa, huge props to Celeste Headlee and On Second Thought for a frank discussion about the harassment issues in public radio, the importance of including diverse voices, age, race, gender, politics, and how she really tried to cover the state of Georgia. Also, J.P. Cunningham wrote on Twitter, the best visit with Celeste Headlee on this X show of hers? Anyone that you were smart enough to listen to. We're going to miss her. You always want to know what you think? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Expressions of anti-Semitic sentiments in Georgia have more than doubled since 2015. That's according to the Georgia Anti-Defamation League, an advocacy group that fights discrimination against Jews. Allison Padilla-Goodman oversees the ADL Southeast region. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning, Adam. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you for being here. 58 anti-Semitic incidents in Georgia in 2017, according to your organization's reckoning. What's a typical one of these incidents? What's one that's a lot like all the others?
Our audit of anti-Semitic incidents tracks vandalism, harassment, and assaults, and we definitely see a lot more harassment and vandalism than assaults, thankfully. So it could be a swastika drawn on a synagogue, or Jews being harassed walking down the street with their yarmulkes on, anti-Semitic bullying in schools. There's quite a gamut.
And are you going off of police reports, or are these things that victims are reporting directly to the ADL?
These are mostly things that victims are reporting directly to the ADL.
Okay. So according to the ADL's numbers, in 2015, there were 16 anti-Semitic incidents in Georgia. 2016, the following year, jumps to 43. And then last year, the last year for which you have data, 2017, 58 anti-Semitic incidents in Georgia. That's a tremendous increase, more than doubling over the last couple of years. What is going on here?
Yeah, it's a national trend. Nationally, we saw a 57% increase in anti-Semitic incidents from last year to this. It's very concerning, and we're looking into the reasons for why. We do not think more people are anti-Semitic, and that is key. Every year we do a survey of anti-Semitic attitudes, and that survey shows year after year that it's about 10 to 12% of the U.S. holds anti-Semitic attitudes. What we're seeing now is, first of all, people are reporting more because they're more concerned about anti-Semitism, but reporting doesn't account for a 60% increase. We are seeing hate groups emboldened. We are seeing them come out in public in ways that we've never seen before. We're seeing people struggle with the divisive rhetoric that they're seeing on television through politics and the news. And then we're seeing young people really struggle in K-12 schools. That's where the largest increase happened. We had 94% increase in anti-Semitic incidents in schools, which is a very disturbing trend.
Yeah. What are the age of the kids who are being harassed in schools typically?
Kindergarten to 12th grade is where we're seeing it the most. We're seeing an enormous amount of bullying and bigotry in schools in general. But we're seeing a huge spike in anti-Semitic incidents in schools, both here in Georgia and on a national scale. We're also seeing anti-Semitism increase on college campuses more than we've seen in the past. Extremist groups are actually recruiting and flyering on college campuses. Sometimes they are hosting rallies and speaking engagements on college campuses. And so these types of sentiment and attitudes are something that all students are really struggling with.
So when you receive a report of an anti-Semitic incident in a school, do you then take that to the school administration and make them aware of what's happened?
Absolutely. For the most part, we have a very robust education initiative. We work in over 250 schools in the region through a program called No Place for Hate, where we get schools to increase their dialogue around diversity and identity. And part of this program is to build relationships with schools so that they actually come to us also when things happen. So we have high demand for our anti-bias trainings, working with schools to help them address incidents when they happen, as well as to proactively build a school culture to prevent these types of things from happening more.
We're talking about a almost threefold increase in anti-Semitic incidents in Georgia since 2015, at least as tallied by the Anti-Defamation League. And we're speaking with the ADL's Allison Padilla-Goodman. Also joining us now is Steve Becton. He's Program Director for Equity and Inclusion with the group Facing History and Ourselves. It's a nonprofit that helps create a safe and inclusive school environment through education. Welcome to the program, Steve.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
How are educators supposed to handle an anti-Semitic incident in a classroom? What's the best practice?
Well, first and foremost, we have to create a social and emotional safe learning environments to have the conversations. That's the first thing we have to do, and that is educators have to be intentional about creating classrooms where these kind of very volatile and difficult things could be discussed, where multiple perspectives can come forth, and kids could sort of courageously have the conversation. So that would be the first step. And then the next thing I would say, Facing History, that we think is huge and important is that we ground these conversations in context. Anti-Semitism and other forms of bigotry, they have a sort of a historical narrative. And as much as we can help students understand the context of what's happening today, they can see how these patterns of discrimination and oppression and bigotry have happened over time and get a little more sophisticated about how dangerous this is.
Yeah. Let me share you a really quick story from my childhood. I have a really, really potent memory of in elementary school, we had a day on discrimination, a day. And that was the first day I'd ever heard of anti-Semitism. I was the first day I ever heard that there was a thing that people don't like Jews. And I think I was not the only kid in class for whom that was a revelation. And I remember that afternoon, the one Jewish kid in our school getting taunted after the idea of anti-Semitism had been introduced to the students by their teachers, which was obviously not the goal of the teachers. And I've always sort of had a lot of questions in my head about that. But Allison, I suppose that's not something that happens too much anymore with a lot of these things coming out into the open, that a lot of kids are coming to school really having been taught about this stuff one way or another before they even get to school. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing it on the news almost nightly. It's been a particularly troubling week watching Farrakhan on the extreme left and Putin on the extreme right, our president using terms like globalist. Anti-Semitism is something that's becoming a little bit too normal on the nightly news.
Could you unpack that for what makes you think that globalist is an anti-Semitic code word?
Sure. So globalist has been used for a very long time from extremist groups. White supremacists have adopted it to describe Jews, describing them as being more loyal to another country than their own. Yeah. And the alt-right has been using it particularly in particular rigor these days. As students see this and, you know, they're trying to kind of understand how to interact with the world. I will say students on the other side are doing really amazing things. So the students participating in our programs, they're talking about identity and bias in ways that stun one, that keep us excited and motivated. I mean, we see these students from Parkland talking about gun control and taking action. I think on the same side, while we're seeing a lot of anti-Semitism in schools, we're also seeing students kind of rise up and come together and take a stand and speak up for one another in ways that we haven't before.
Steve, I imagine you've seen this incident of a middle school teacher in Florida who has fessed up to the fact that she was hosting a white nationalist podcast where there was a lot of anti-Semitic stuff being uttered, among other anti things. She has since said that her podcast was satire. That's an explanation that I think strains credibility. She has been put on leave, I believe, or possibly fired. The school is acting, but only after the media, I think it was the Huffington Post, broke the story that you had this middle school teacher who was had this side hustle of hosting this racist podcast. How do you think the school is supposed to handle a situation like that? She talked on her podcast about how she was essentially undercover at her school, that she had lied to people about her true feelings about things so that she could sneak white supremacist ideology into the classroom. How are you supposed to handle a person like that if you're a school administrator, Steve?
Well, I do know about that incident. I think the bigger issue, well, I don't know all the details of that incident, but I will say this. I think the number one sort of issue for school administrators is to protect students. I hope that's an extreme example. I hope most of our teachers are not a critical mass of our teachers are undercover, you know, hosting hate sites. So on a daily basis, though, I think administrators really do have to be intentional and vigilant about protecting vulnerable students in schools, protecting students who have been historically marginalized, whether it be around race or religion or their sexual identity. So it's about, I think administrators today have to be vigilant about building a school culture and climate that's just doesn't, not only that it responds to bigotry, but it discourages bigotry every day by having intentional conversations, by having intentional places in the curriculum where students are taking deep dives into moments in history. That's what we do at Facing History. We provide these case studies, for example, for kids to study the rise of the Nazis in Germany so that they could see patterns, again, patterns of oppression and bigotry and be able to notice them when they're happening today. So administrators are to create this school culture that just discourages this kind of behavior on a daily basis.
That's Steve Becton of the group Facing History on Ourselves. We also spoke with Allison Padilla Goodman of the Anti-Defamation League of Georgia, which finds a almost threefold increase in anti-Semitic incidents in Georgia over the last couple of years. It's on Second Thought. It's on Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. A popular TV show with a familiar title is back. Since FX debuted its show Atlanta in 2016, it has racked up multiple awards and gotten a lot of critical acclaim. The series presents a very authentic and nuanced perspective of Atlanta, especially its Black community. That community is also well represented behind the scenes. The show is set in Atlanta and shot in Atlanta. Joel Ray Ishman and Quolin Bradley work as stand-in actors. On Second Thought, contributor Kalina Bowler talked with them about their experiences working on the show's second season. Quolin says there was something magical about it even before filming began.
So I started during the pilot, and it was a very hot summer in Atlanta with Joel, actually. And the very first day, we were reading over the sides, and we were like, this show is going to blow up. Mm-hmm. Like, we knew it from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And since then, working the entire pilot, working the entire first season, and now the entire second season, that same feeling that we had on the first day about the level of consciousness that this story and this the storytelling of the crew and the cast and everything, but also the level of commitment and discipline that everyone has to creating a great show that's impactful, that reflects Atlanta well, but it's also funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's very rare. I feel like from the very beginning, we had that conversation and nothing's changed.
Yep.
That's amazing. And Joel, Paperboy is... he's a phenomenon now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're referencing Paperboy across all media right now. How was it being hired to play this now iconic role?
Well, I mean, definitely shout out to Brian Tyree Henry. he's a good guy. He's a good guy first.
Yeah.
And then he's an amazing actor as well. You know, he's amazing. Done Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
He played in The Book of Mormon on Broadway. So he's classically trained as an actor. So just watching his performance, it's inspiring to see, you know.
When you're called in and they say, oh, all right, we need the stand-ins.
Mm-hmm. Second team.
Do you guys imagine yourselves as the characters, or do you imagine yourselves as the actors portraying the characters when you do your stand-ins?
I think, first of all, for me...
Or is it literally just standing there?
No. Like, some productions, that's all you do, but those productions don't understand the art of blocking, and blocking is an art.
Right.
But for this one, because we're working with artist Hiro Murai, who's the director, is amazing, and he's worked with Donald Glover on multiple videos, and so they have a lot of non-verbals. But when we actually get the script, we actually go over the lines. When I do it as myself. I don't want to replicate anything that Lakeith would do, because he's artistically, he's one of the, to me, he's like an artistic genius. Like, he knows his beats, he knows what's going on. So when I get it as an artist, I bring my own flavor to it, and I go through the same beats, but I make it my own.
Is definitely a process of collaboration. And, you know, because we are actors as well, we definitely bring our own flavor to those characters, so that even with Hiro and even with the cast, they sometimes can see what we do and say, I like that.
All right. Well, let me ask you guys this, because you're shedding light on what a stand-in is there for.
Mm-hmm.
So I want you to walk me through...
the technical aspect of
like
standing
the day.
In.
Yeah. So let's just say it's production day 5 of 80 or whatever. And it's the day. The call is in. Everybody's like, okay, call time is 7 a.m. It's 7 a.m.
Yeah.
What happens? How do you guys get to work?
Go ahead, Q. Touch
on. All right, so I'll make it quick. Get to work. We go to wardrobe, get our color cover.
Make color sure that, covers. Explain what color covers are.
Make sure that we look like the character, so that the colors that we're wearing match the actor's
So you wear the exact
costume.
Same wardrobe?
Exact same it's similar colored wardrobe.
Like if the character is wearing a brown shirt, we'll go and get a brown shirt from.
But it's not necessarily the exact same.
Unless we're doing photo doubling, which is a whole another right. thing where we have the exact same look. But for the most part, typical day, we'll just go and make sure the color cover matches so that the color looks right when we're setting up the shot.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get our sides. We'll read over the entire sides for the entire
Explain
day.
Explain what sides
and
are.
Sides, I'm sorry for those in the industry, is just basically your script for the day.
Okay.
Every scene in order from where you're going to shoot it. And so we go over those. We memorize every single
Yeah, we do. Explain why we do that, Q.
Because in the standing role is it's so important, and that's why I say blocking is an art. And people that have that utilize stand-ins the proper way, the production runs so much more smoother. Because you're the guy that's in there while the actor's like, you know, going over their performance.
They're getting hair and makeup done, making sure their wardrobe is good.
Right. You're the guy that's in there that's making sure that the light hits them right. You're the one that making sure that that you hit your mark right. And when you hit that mark at a certain line, the focus perillo is going to do something during that time. So they need to hear that line at that mark, or they need to hear not even only marks. So they need to hear a line when you pick up something, and they need to make sure the camera is getting it, make sure the lighting is getting it. So it's extremely technical, but at the same time, it's so necessary because people look at our day like, oh, it's TV. It's no big deal. No, there's 12 hour days. Yeah. We're actually going at over least 2-3 scenes and that's it. Cause we want to make sure that every shot is thought about, you know, every part of the blocking, and that's what we're there for, is storytelling. So there's a reason why, for example, you hit a mark during this line instead of another line. That's why it's so important for us to know what's happening, what's going on. So we set up shots throughout the day, and we just do it over and over. Every single shot, every single turn of the camera, they bring us in to make sure that the blocking is right.
Everything is rehearsed. We go through the lines. We memorize the lines because it just makes it easier for us and the crew to go through the actual lines so that everybody can get everything set as far as camera movement and shots and the lighting. So
you're literally not just standing. You're acting.
You're acting.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just we not on camera.
Acting. Gotcha. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So that's the technical setup of a stand-in.
I love it.
So.
And to be honest, I had no idea. And I've been doing this now 15 years. I didn't know.
There's basically a stand-in on every production. Check this out. Samuel L. Jackson was Bill Cosby's stand-in on The Cosby Show.
And then Anthony Mackie was Samuel L. Jackson's stand-in as well on many productions.
Yeah.
So it's such a good proving ground and training ground for developing actors.
Yeah.
So they can understand the art of being on TV film.
Samuel L. Jackson used to wear the sweaters and everything.
Okay. Y'all are blowing my mind because that's amazing. I didn't realize.
Yeah.
Wow. So you would then suggest this for people who want to act and want to get into it? 100%.
100%. Not only does it sharpen your skills, it gives you that on-set experience. So then when you are called to be part of a cast or to do first team, you have on-set experience, actual on-set experience of what your day as a cast member is going to be.
And Q, talk to me about so far the best experience that you have had as a stand-in on any show that you've worked on, TV or movies. Go ahead, Q. Go ahead.
Yeah, I got to say it. Yeah, I just finished the last major film that I did was Black Panther, and I was a stand-in for Chadwick Boseman. It was such a benefit as an actor to work so closely with a cinematographer and a director and a first AD that is visionary, and we understand, and I couldn't understand how they put shots together. I could understand how the whole world came together through their eyes, and that experience is invaluable.
Right. That's amazing. How about you?
Yeah. For me, my best experience would be Atlanta. And I've had some great experiences on other shows as a stand-in just because of how I approach the stand-in position. I was a stand-in on a Ricky Smiley show for 3 seasons, and that was great. Great crew, great cast. And Atlanta is pretty much the same. It's a small crew. It's a small crew for a TV show. And then also the head honcho, Donald Glover, he's a humble guy. When we were on set and we got word of his Grammy nominations, you know what I'm saying? And I was like, hey man, that's a good look, man. He was like, yeah man, so you know, it's a lot of good people in the categories. You know, he's that type of guy. Like, dude, you just got nominated for 5 Grammys and you on your own hit TV show. He could be a certain way if he wanted to, but he's just a cool dude. He's just a regular humble guy. And so because he's the boss, everybody under him is humble and cool as well. So like, even if you come on set and you don't have that peaceful, humble attitude, you stand out in a bad way because the top dog is like, you know, how y'all doing? You know, he speaks to everybody, and, you know, it's just a, it's that type of vibe on set. It's definitely for the culture. So that experience, just seeing somebody as young as Donald doing what he loves to do in a position that he's in, writer, producer, actor, it's just a special vibe on set that everybody contributes to. So it's a great experience, man.
That's Joel Ray Ishman. He's a stand-in on FX's Atlanta. We also heard from fellow Atlanta stand-in Quilden Bradley. They spoke with On Second Thought contributor Kalina Bowler. Kalina is the host of The Credits Podcast. Listen online at thecreditspodcast.com. And a program note, Wednesday we return behind the scenes of FX's Atlanta with its co-executive producer, Hiro Murai. Well, FX's Atlanta is just one of the many entertainment projects that are made in Georgia and contribute to the multi-billion dollar local industry that it has become. So you ask, what else is shooting? Let's go on set in Georgia.
Here we go. Movie!
In Georgia!
We make films.
Movies?
Let's go to the movies.
Let's go see the stars.
Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter Jennifer Brett writes for the AJC's Atlanta Buzz blog. Jennifer, welcome back.
Good morning.
Atlanta should maybe be called the world's superhero headquarters. Marvel's Black Panther was partially filmed here, and it just passed the billion-dollar mark at the box office. Here's a scene from the film featuring Chadwick Boseman and 92-year-old actress Dorothy Steele, who is from Atlanta.
Crow has escaped our pursuits for almost 30 years. Not capturing him is perhaps my father's greatest regret. I wish to bring Claw back here to stand trial.
Wakanda does not need a warrior right now. We need a king.
Jennifer, Black Panther is not going to be the last Marvel flick filmed in Atlanta. What else is going on?
Oh, my goodness, no. Black Panther is just the latest of many Marvel productions to shoot here. Coming up next, we're going to look out for Avengers Infinity War due out this spring. And then Avengers, whatever they call the next one, still a working title, is going to come out in 2019. Captain Marvel is shooting now in Los Angeles, but I would not be surprised to see a little bit of work done here on that project as well. There's kind of been this tug of war coast to coast due to, you know, tax credits, and it's basically whoever can, you know, work out the best deal. But Samuel L. Jackson is starring in that one once again as Nick Fury, Brie Larson in the title role. So we're going to see that one coming out next. Ant-Man and the Wasp is among the other projects that have filmed here. Ant-Man was the very first Marvel production filmed here in Atlanta, headquartered out of Pinewood. AUE Screen Gems also is getting in on the action. That's where Black Panther filmed. I am waiting for the announcement of Black Panther 2. Fingers crossed that we'll be hearing that at some point and that it'll be filming in Atlanta.
Let's move on to some other productions. One thing we know about actor Will Smith is that he doesn't like bugs. Here he is in Men in Black.
Well, well. Big bad bug got a bit of a soft spot, huh? See, what I can't understand is why you gotta come down here bringing all this ruckus.
Turns out poor Will Smith is now getting eaten alive by Georgia bugs. He turned to social media to complain about the state's insect population. He is in Savannah, below the gnat line, working on a new film. What can you tell us about what he's working on?
Yeah, poor Will Smith. He doesn't like bugs, but they apparently love him. He posted this really funny Instagram clip of him wearing a bug net, and he said the off that he's spraying on is just attracting them and having the opposite effect of the desired effect. He's filming Gemini Man. He stars as an over-the-hill hitman who faces off against a younger clone of himself. So it's going to be Will Smith versus Will Smith and all the bugs in Georgia in addition. This has been filming, like you say, in the Savannah area, and so the other day he was tromping through the swamps, I think in the Pooler area, like right before you get to Savannah, so hopefully he'll learn to coexist with all our critters down here.
In another Georgia project, Ryan Gosling is going where few men have gone before.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Gosling stars in a new movie based on the first moon landing. Jennifer, what can you tell us about it?
Yeah, this is First Man. It's due out in October of this year. He stars as the space hero. This is not the first space race movie to be filmed in Atlanta, of course. Hidden Figures was filmed here a couple years ago and got lots of acclaim. We're going to see some local spots showing up on the big screen when First Man is out. It filmed in a number of area locations, including the Briarcliff Mansion that's part of Emory. So look out for that.
Well, as we just heard, Samuel L. Jackson may have been a stand-in for Bill Cosby at one time, but he typically plays a mean, down-to-business, no-muss-no-fuss characters.
Now, do you ever want to see me again? Do you ever want to see me again? No. What's my name? I forgot. What's my name? God, Shaft.
Samuel L. Jackson has been working on another installment of the Shaft series. Jennifer, what do you know about it?
Looking forward to this one. He actually gave us a little sneak preview of the Shaft action when Samuel L. Jackson showed up at the Black Panther screening that Atlanta hosted right before that movie came out. It was held at the Fox Theater, and Samuel L. Jackson appeared on the screen, on the stage rather, right before Black Panther aired. He talked about working on Shaft. He's a Morehouse man, so of course no stranger to Atlanta. Always great to see him back, and looking forward to this one.
In the last 30 seconds, let's take a moment to salute one of the worst films of 2017, which was, we're very proud to say, made right here in Georgia. What film takes the title?
Oh, man, this is Baywatch, the adaptation of the TV series. This was filmed down in the Tybee Island area, and it could have been so fun and so funny, but it just was kind of gross. And so it was up for the Razzie, the sort of anti-Oscars. Unfortunately, the Emoji movie was even worse and managed to edge Baywatch aside, but Razzies didn't let the Baywatch go home without any hardware. They kind of cooked up a new award. The adaptation won the movie so bad you kind of loved it eventually, but I think it was pretty awful.
That's Jennifer Brett with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Atlanta Buzz Blog. Thank you, Jennifer. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Tomorrow, we examine the largest slave auction in U.S. history. It's been called the Weeping Time, and it happened in Savannah. This event is not particularly well known. We'd like to hear from you. Is there a historical event that you think deserves more attention? Something that happened here in the South or in Georgia? Give us a call. Leave a message. We're at 404-500-9457. And be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Today, we look at some of the newest books by Southern authors, things that you should check out and put on your summer reading list, maybe. We're going to talk with Allison Law, host of the Literary Atlanta podcast. Hi, Allison.
Hello, Adam. How are you?
I'm lovely. Also with us is Decatur-based author Nikki Salcedo. Her most recent novel is All Beautiful Things. Welcome back, Nikki.
Hi, good morning.
Allison, the author Anthony Grooms has a story based on a real-life, racially motivated killing from 1946. What is this book and why did you choose it?
The name of the book is The Vang Conversation. This is Anthony Grooms' novel that came out back in, actually on March the 1st, and it is based on the Moore's Landing lynching, which, like you said, happened in 1946, and is sometimes referred to as the last mass lynching in the United States. There was two African-American couples. A white lynch mob grabbed them from their cars, shot and killed them. One of the women was pregnant, and it is, to this day, an unsolved crime.
And it happened up in North Georgia, right?
It did. It happened in a place where Anthony Grooms drove by every day when he was teaching at the University of Georgia. So that and an article that came out in the 1990s in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution inspired the story. That 1990s article was the story of Clinton Adams, who was just a boy, and he was a white boy in that county, and he witnessed the lynching, knew all of the faces. But like happens in the Vang Conversation, he was unable to tell the story of what he witnessed.
Yeah. You spoke with Grooms on your podcast, and one of the things they talked about was how problems that originate from slavery, drawing a clear line between slavery and what happened in 1946, how problems originating from slavery continue to exist. Here he is from your podcast.
We look at slavery, and we see that slavery ended, and then reinvented itself for another 100 years. But we can look also at other societies, particularly if we look in the Middle East right now, but in other places in Africa, these long-held hostilities continue decade after decade.
This sounds like a heavy read, Allison.
It is a heavy read. And the thing that Anthony and I mentioned or talked about during the Literary Atlanta podcast too, was that this is a work of fiction. It's inspired by true events. But what you are able to get by reading a fictionalized account of the story, and he tells the story from different perspectives, that of Lonnie, who is the boy who witnesses the lynching, that of Bertrand, who is one of the people who was lynched, and then a couple of the members of the lynch mob. You're able to kind of answer some of the questions that will never be answered in this case. And the title of the book, The Vain Conversation, is in a biblical allusion to a conversation about race and the things that we're uncomfortable talking about that keep coming up.
Let's talk about another book that people should put on their list. Nikki, you chose Tayeri Jones' book, American Marriage, as one of your favorite books. It was recently included in Oprah's book club, so it's going to do pretty well. Why'd you choose it?
Well, I really liked that this was a story about two regular people. The voice of the story is contemporary, it's real and accessible, and the story sort of proves that a marriage is not just a story of two people. It's a story of our parents. It's a story of our friends. It's a story of the choices that we make. And I can see why it's a complicated and tough read about relationships, but I think it's interesting and real.
It points to issues surrounding wrongful incarceration. In an interview with you, Allison, Tayeri Jones says that the book was inspired by a conversation that she overheard.
I was in Atlanta visiting my mama. I went out to Lenox because I was stressed and I do like to shop. And I overheard a couple arguing, and the woman said, "Roy, you know you wouldn't have waited on me for 7 years." And he said, "You know, I don't know what you're talking about. This wouldn't have happened to you in the first place." And I was so intrigued by this argument.
So, Nikki, it sounds like another heavy read, but one worthwhile.
It is one worthwhile, and it's good to read a book where you ask yourself, what would I do in that situation? It's always, you know, great to say you would make all the right choices, but in reality, we know, and as we read, we don't know what we would do in those situations, and I enjoy a story where I take myself to those complicated questions and answers.
Allison, in that interview with you, Tayeri Jones explains why she chose to set part of her book in a prison. Let's listen.
Prison is one of the few places where people regularly write letters. And I felt like in the book, it gave also kind of a nostalgic moment of the letter writing. Like Roy says, "I'm going to write you a love letter. I never wrote you love letters when we were together, and I regret that now."
Boy, I'd never thought of it like that. Allison, how does Jones sort of weave letter writing into the story that she tells?
Because the two people who are married in an American marriage, Roy and Celestial, they've only been married 18 months when Roy is wrongly convicted of a violent crime and sentenced to 12 years. And the only way that they can communicate with each other at that time is through letters. And Tayeri Jones was saying that she wants to bring letter writing back. She writes all of her books on typewriters and has a little bit of a typewriter problem. She owns 12 and has limited herself to 12, but she thinks that, you know, we need to go back to that that craft of writing letters to each other. So that was a way of this couple who are involved in this horrible situation. This is the only way that they can communicate with each other. These intimate details of their relationship is through these letters.
We're talking about some of the newest books by Southern authors that you should consider checking out. My guests are Allison Law of the Literary Atlanta podcast. Also, author Nikki Salcedo is with us. Allison, you chose the book Brass by author Jeanette Alleyou. What's this one about?
I love this book. I love this book. And I'm really not alone in this because it was one of the most anticipated books of 2018. Brass is the story about the author, Jeanette Alleyou's hometown of Waterbury, Connecticut. She grew up in Connecticut, then moved to North Carolina to attend MFA, to get her MFA. And she thought that everybody knew about this town that was founded on kind of the brass industry and the brass mills. So that explains a little bit about the title. But when she moved away from home, she realized that she had all of these stories from home, and this was one of them. It started kind of as a short story and then became the novel. It's two coming-of-age stories in one. So it goes back and forth between 1996. We have Elsie in a relationship with this Albanian line cook at a Greek diner named after the Betsy Ross, an American patriot. And then you go into the next chapter and you meet her daughter, who is Julieta. And so it's really, really an interesting story as you go back and forth and learn about these two women.
I understand the original focus of this book is a little bit different from what Jeanette initially had in mind. Here's what she had to say about that in an interview on your podcast, Allison.
My agent asked the question that every beginning writer should actually ask themselves before they consider something finished, which is, why are you telling the story now? What's the significance of the story at this point? And I had to think, well, she's probably, you know, at this point, maybe got a, you know, her daughter is asking these kinds of questions and might be having these same kinds of identity conflicts. And my agent was like, well, then write her.
Nikki, is that something that resonates with you as an author?
It definitely does. It's always great to have an agent or an editor who gives you a little tidbit into making the story much more alive. And I love that clip. And in the story, I'm at a stage in my life where I assume I'm going to identify with one character more than another. And as you read the story, you really feel for both of these two women and this certain time in your life where you're exploring love and wanting something more than life has given you. So it's definitely a great read.
Yeah, that's Brass by author Jeanette Aliou. Nikki, let's go to another pick of yours. You chose a book called A Scholar of Pain, Short Stories by Grant Jerkins. What's this one?
Yes, Grant is a local author, and I think that short stories don't get the play that novels get as much. And I run into a lot of people who say, you know, I don't have the time to read a book. I can't finish a book. And short stories are really a wonderful window into fiction in a way that works with our current society where, you know, we might have compressed time. And many of these stories in A Scholar of Pain were previously published. This is a collection of short stories. And so you'll hear different voices. There are stories about addiction, about family relationships. And I love having glimpses into these little vignettes, these little photos of people's lives, even fictional people.
Let's try to sneak in one more pick, Nikki. You chose Gods of Howl Mountain by Taylor Brown. What's this one?
This is really a terrifying book. It's wonderful to read a book that at each page, you're wondering what's happening. It's set in a small mountain town in North Carolina, and the main character has come back from the war, who's been wounded, and sort of a town of criminals and an element of the underworld there. And prominent is his granny, who is another kind of terrifying character. I felt like it was so Shakespearean and Greek in the way it was presented. The language was Gothic and foreboding. And in a way, Southern literature has veered away from this kind of very Gothic style. And I love seeing it come back where it's grim and real and gritty.
Yeah, Allison Law of the Literary Atlanta podcast, based on the picks that you and Nikki Salcedo have brought here about what latest books from Southern authors people should be checking out this year, where is Southern literature at right now? Where's its head?
Oh, goodness. We could have a whole debate about what is and what isn't Southern literature because, you know, of the authors that we have represented here, Anthony Grooms is Virginia, Jeanette Aliou is Connecticut, Grant is Georgia, Tayari is Georgia, Taylor is from the coast of Georgia. So, I mean, does it mean that they're Southern writers or, you know, Taylor's kind of, they've termed his as Appalachian Gothic? I think it's more... It is more reflective of the fact that the South is more and more diversified, and we have all of these incredible voices who have different past experiences and different perspectives, different ways of telling a story, different themes to explore. So I think that my short answer after giving you a long answer is that Southern literature is very rich and has so much to be mined.
Nikki, you say Southern Gothic is back. Is that what the flavor of the month right now in Southern literature, or is there something more to it?
I hope so. I think sometimes the rest of the country demands something of the South, some sort of apology for history and culture. And I think authors should step forward with their true stories. And some of them are gritty and grim and unhappy. And some of them are fun and light and more accessible to our current world. And we shouldn't have to pick one style. And I'm glad that we have a good selection these days.
You certainly do. Decatur-based author Nikki Salcedo, who we just heard from there. We were also talking to Allison Law of the Literary Atlanta podcast, letting us know about the best in Southern literature that you should be checking out this year. If you missed any of those authors and titles, don't worry. Information about all of their picks is at gpmenews.org. Allison and Nikki, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Atlanta's Beltline winds through different neighborhoods of the city for miles. Along the way, cyclists, walkers, and runners see public art displays along the trail. There are also live musicians. On Second Thought, producer Maura Curry went for a walk on the East Side Trail last week for the sights and sounds of the Beltline.
My name is Masiki Scales. I am the band leader for Common Ground Collective, and we've been one of the feature performers yearly on the Beltline. I have a melodica. It's sort of a piano harmonica, and I actually played it during the Lantern Parade this year. You all ready to have a little parade today?
I am Miranda Kyle. I'm the Arts and Culture Program Manager for the Atlanta Beltline. We are currently standing on one of the little gateway trails from the skate park up to the Freedom Parkway overpass on the East Side Trail. On the left here, you have Phil Proctor's column. This was made entirely out of reclaimed railroad artifacts. Historically accurate, and is one of our permanent pieces that was commissioned for the Beltline. Atlanta doesn't have to be New York. We don't have to be Chicago. We don't have to be Austin. We have incredible talent in this city. They just need the opportunity to shine and the funding for it. You know, that's really all it is. Like, I think that Atlanta is the cultural hub of the South, and we gotta pay our artists. We gotta help them live and thrive here in the city. That way we keep them here and keep them working, because that's what we want. That's what made Atlanta incredible to begin with, was our incredibly amazing creative makers here in the city. So we can't lose them. I want to support those makers, and the Beltline wants to support those makers, so that's what we're going to do.
That's Miranda Kyle, the director of Atlanta's Art on the Beltline. That story was produced by On Second Thought's Maura Curry. And that's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. We just talked about some of the latest books by Southern authors. What do you think we missed? Call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk. Our show is produced by Maura Curry, Fenley Foxen, LaRaven Taylor, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is the senior producer, Don Smith edits the show, and Tanya Ott is the executive producer. Our engineer is Tyler Morris. Special thanks to our interns, Emmanuel Johnson, Emily Bunker, and Reed Williams. The theme music is Silent Machine by Georgia's own Cat Power. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Have a good one.